Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, instead of playing the second half of my interview with the amazing Norman Corwin, and if you were listening last week, you heard the first part, and I promised the second part for this week, but instead I am playing an interview with Wes Grantham, who directed a production of Tartuffe for the Oslo Repertory Company, and it is only running for a little bit longer, so I wanted to get this interview and the review on in time for you to hear it in case you can get down to come and see it. So Norman Corwin will be in the near future, but not today. So hang on, here come the show. Is about congruence. Sometimes I talk about that in specific terms. The word congruence, I should look it up sometime and see what it says in the dictionary. What it means to therapists, one of whom I am, is the ability to be who you really are. That is, what you see is what you got. You know, what there is what you see. There's not a big divide between the person and the way the person is behaving or the way the person feels about themselves. It's not uncommon for me to have clients when I ask them something about what do they want, and they say, oh, I don't know what I want. I never know what I want. I've never known what I want. And then I need to remind them that when they were 2 and 4, unless it had already been beaten out of them, they very definitely knew what they wanted. And if you have access to a 2-year-old or have seen a 2-year-old, you know perfectly well that there's no I don't know what I want there. And quite often that's equally true for teenagers. You know, even with the toddlers, they know, you know, I want to wear the pink shirt, not the blue. I want to wear the shorts. I don't want to wear the pants. I want to go to sleep. I don't want to go to sleep. I want to eat that, but I don't want to eat this. It's, you know, that we come into life with a powerful sense of what we want, who we are, what works for us. So when I have a client who's 20 or 40 or 60 and they say to me, I've never known what I want, I know that's not true. And not only do I know that that's not true, I know that what they want is still there. That they could know what they want, but they've forgotten that they can know what they want. That there's a person in there who absolutely knows what they want, but they have created the capacity to be in denial for that. And, of course, that's not the only thing for which we are able to be in denial. We human beings are quite capable of forgetting under the pressure of it not working in our family of origin or in our school. Just remembering that, I've told this story before, my mother, when she was a teenager, was in a classroom where, for some reason, people were asked to stand up and perform, and my mother stood up and she sang, and she had a really big belt voice, and the teacher apparently didn't like that. So the teacher said to the class in a tone which made it clear how one was supposed to respond, "So, how many people like that kind of voice?" Well, my mother stopped singing. Stopped thinking of herself as someone who could sing. Stopped thinking of herself as someone who loved to sing. Put singer away. And again, this is just, there are many thousands of ways in which we can be undermined. Did you get chastised for crying? Maybe called a crybaby? Or for laughing? Or for piping up your opinion? Or for not doing well enough in school, or for doing too well, or, you know, I mean, possibilities are endless. So, the Lynn Show is intended to remind you week after week that there may be things about you which you are hiding, and not just from the rest of us, but from yourself. And as I always say when I'm talking about this, not only do you not have access to that part of yourself that would bring you pleasure, that might make your life easier, that just all kinds of benefits accrue to being able to be who you are, but in addition, it requires energy to suppress who we are. So there's energy in there that you don't have access to. And it may be that some of the things that you're suppressing are things that when they come out, you don't actually like them. But it is still better to know who you are and to be able to accept your entire self. This is not going to come as a surprise to any of you. But if there's a part of you that you don't like, even if you are not consciously aware of it, somehow you know and you feel flawed. You know, the old fraud experience dynamic. I'm a fraud, if they really knew me. Even if you don't know what it is, that if they really knew, they wouldn't like. You suspect that there's something in there that if they really knew, they wouldn't like. So, it's my mission to attempt to help you pay attention. Do you have a hint? Do you have a suspicion that there's something about you that you have not been demonstrating, haven't had access to? Even just thinking about it can change the whole dynamic. And although I haven't had an opportunity to talk that much about it in the recent shows because the interviews have been so compelling and that they have taken up so much of the show. But the last time I talked about this, I talked about the relationship contract. That is, the contract that although unwritten and unacknowledged exists between all people who are in relationship with one another. And the clause, there's only one clause in it, and it is, I'll be who I am, and you be who you are. And as long as we continue to honor that, then the relationship is fine. But when we change it, there is the possibility that the other person will not take kindly to it. I will talk more about this in future shows, I promise. There is more about this in past shows. So let me say now that if you're interested in any of this, you can go up on my website, thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, S-H-O-W, thelynshow.com. There you can hear the current shows. You can hear the show that I played last week, the first part of my interview with Norman Corwin, and also some of Norman's radio plays. You can hear this show if you hear it and you want to hear it again. And there's a list on the side of the first page of my website that tells you where you can find things. So there'd be a spot for the relationship contract, and if you wanted to learn what I have already said about that, you can click on that, and the shows in which I have talked about that will come up. Or there's a spot for playwright, and there's a spot for actor, and et cetera, to quote The King and I. So you can go up there and listen to what I've already said about these things. Also, I wrote a book about this called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And there is, if it's not a complete chapter on the relationship contract, but it is, there is a lot of information about it. So you can go up on that and get the book or the audiobook. I recorded an audiobook of it. Also, you might be interested to know that I do my entire psychotherapy practice on the phone these days, and I wrote an article about that because that is unfamiliar to a lot of people, and that article is called Psychotherapy on the Go, and you can download that if you're interested in finding out about that. And you can email me. Just click on Contact Me and write me anything. You can also follow the show on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and please comment. Please write what you think of anything that I have said or done, or the interviews or the show or the idea or any of it. So if you were listening to the lead-in to the show, you know I am not playing the second half of my interview with Norman Corwin. Instead, I am playing the interview with Wes Grantham, who is a director and has directed Tartuffe for the Oslo Repertory Theater, actually for the conservatory part of the Oslo Repertory Theater, the conservatory. And this show is currently playing, and as you will hear at the very end, is only running through May 1st, and it's terrific. And so I wanted to get this interview and the review for the show, which follows the interview, onto the radio in time for you to get down and see it if you haven't already or weren't planning to. So I'm putting off Norman and playing Wes at the moment. So, okay, if you're curious, you can always go up on my website to see what will be playing when. And now I think I'm just going to play the interview with Wes, and following that will be the review of Tartuffe. And we talk about the steadfast in this interview. Unfortunately, that has already been on. You will not be able to hear that, but to go and see the reading of the steadfast. The reading that Wes is talking about is coming up next week in New York. And hopefully this will be at some theater in the near future where you can see it. But I'm going to play the interview with Steve Alpert, I think, next week, and on my website will be a photograph of the painting on which the steadfast is based. Okay, enough from me. Here we have Wes Grantham.
Well, okay, I'm here with Wes Grantham in a conference room at the Oslo. And Wes is currently directing two different plays here. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah, Tartuffe.
Tartuffe.
And also The Steadfast?
The Steadfast is a reading.
It's a reading for the Unplugged series.
Yes.
At the Oslo. And Tartuffe is at the historic Oslo? Is
yes,
that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, good. All right. And you're not local? You are local?
No, I live in New York.
You do? Okay, so you came down here to do that, and you wound up getting these two things at the same time, so...
Well, I've been in touch with Greg Lemming, who runs the conservatory program,
right.
For a couple of years about directing Tartuffe. And it just so happened that I was also workshopping this play, The Steadfast, with a writer named Matt Smart. And so while I was here, Matt and I have a big workshop in New York in late April. And so he was going to just come down just to spend time with me in my apartment. And you know, on my time off. It's a strange schedule here because the students are still in class. So
right.
I have my days free. So Matt was just going to come down and
right.
hang out with me. And we're going to talk about the play and
right.
work on it. Probably on the beach or something.
Yes, of course. Well, you know.
and so I mentioned it to Greg, and he said, well, let me see the play, because perhaps we have this festival, and perhaps we can fit you guys in. And so I sent him the play, and he enjoyed it, and he sent it around to Lauren Sasso, who curates with him. So, yeah, that's how it all came together.
Oh, it worked out great.
Yeah, terrific.
That's great. Okay, so as you... sort of surmised from looking at my website,
mm-hmm.
I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, and I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I'm guessing that is true of you, and that the art is theater, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I always ask the same question, and it is, how did it happen? How did it capture you? How did you find it? How did it start?
Well, I think like a lot of directors and playwrights and stage managers, everyone sort of start, in the theater at least, everyone starts as an actor. So that's how I started.
Okay, so when was the very first time it occurred to you that you might like to be an actor?
Well, I grew up in Texas,
mm-hmm.
And I was very big into football. And so when I got into high school, I sort of had to make a choice. I was interested in drama, but if I was cast in the play, I couldn't make football practice. So I went and auditioned. I was very worried about telling my grandfather in particular, my dad, that I was going to quit football to do theater.
Okay, wait a second now. I'm going to back you up.
Sure.
When did you discover that you had any interest in drama?
Oh, when it was, you know, in like fifth grade, I think, when you're getting ready to go to junior high, they send around an elective sheet, the first time you ever get to pick your classes.
Ah.
And there was a choice that said dramatic arts or drama, whatever it
okay,
said.
Okay, well, what made a boy who was going to play football think he might be interested in dramatic arts or whatever?
That's the first memory I have of ever getting to make that choice. I've always been interested in stories. I've always been interested in movies.
Okay, back up even more then.
Okay.
And tell me, did someone read to you? Did they take you to the movies?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, where the interest in stories started then?
Sure. I mean, just being told stories. I have a lot of cousins, and my grandfather, I think we had seven cousins, and my grandfather would take us to the lake on the weekends, and it would always come down to late at night, we'd make a campfire or something, and or sit around the fireplace or wherever we could, and he would tell us some crazy stories. And
wow.
And a lot of them were to do with cowboys and Indians and all these.
Okay, so that the family lived close to each other,
yes.
aunts and uncles, and
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, everyone sort of lives around the Houston area.
Right.
And so we'd get together about 2 hours from Houston at the family lake house, and, you know, it would always end up that we were being told these stories, crazy stories, and we were told them as if they were actually true. And,
Not once upon a time,
but, like, my grandfather would be like, let me tell you about this girl I knew named Dirty Gertie, who was the wildest woman in the West, or whatever.
Really?
And, yeah, and he would tell me, and there are all sorts of characters, and one time, we really fell for it all. We really believed this crazy story about these bandits that had escaped, And so we woke up one night, I don't know, it must have been like 1 o'clock in the morning, and my grandfather and my uncles had actually staged some sort of thing out in the horse pasture where they were, like, Dirty Gertie and her guys had come to, like, steal the horses. And so, and then my grandfather, of course, saved the day.
So whether they intended to or not, they were acting.
They were, right.
And, you know, I mean, you come from apparently a long line of playwrights and actors.
Right.
Whether they called themselves that or not, that is actually what they were doing, right?
Exactly, yeah. And I actually didn't think about that at the time, or I probably haven't thought about it that way until now.
But, I mean, really, I mean, forgive me, but this is not a common story. You don't hear a lot of guys saying, so my grandfather would sit us down and tell us these stories, which, you know, invent these stories, and then my uncles and he would act them out.
Right.
I mean, I don't remember ever hearing.
Well, I think it only happened the once where they acted
but
it out.
But it stands out,
it
doesn't
does,
it?
It does stand out.
Yeah. And where are you? Are the rest of your cousins older or younger than you? Are you in the middle?
I was in the middle.
Yeah?
Yeah, I have two older cousins and then several younger cousins.
Boys and girls?
Boys and girls. Yeah.
Right. Did anybody else go into theater?
No. No, not at all. My brother gave it a shot for a little while, but, you know, he didn't do it very long in high school. He didn't like it very much. And, no.
It's because it is interesting, this, your grandfather loving stories, loving drama, because that's what he was doing. He was
right.
Creating drama for you, you know.
Right.
And yet at the same time, being somebody you were concerned about telling that you fell for this really hard, and it was, in a way, his fault.
Right,
You know, I mean, I'm sure you didn't say, well, Grandpa, you shouldn't have told us those stories because now I'm going to be an actor.
Right. But, no, of course, but even as I, you know, as I grew up and pursued a career in it, and then, I think he was very surprised, even as I started getting hired to direct theater, that I could actually make a living at it. My wife's an actor, and my grandfather, I was very close to her as well, and he was always asking questions, you know, well, how are you guys doing this? You know, does it pay any money?
So that was what he was concerned about.
Yeah.
Not that you weren't going to be a macho boy on the football field.
But that it wasn't a viable career path.
Career. Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So here, it's, you know, you're in the fifth or sixth grade, and you see this as an option, dramatic arts, and something inside you, although apparently not anything really well defined, says, oh, let me look at that. Is this accurate? Don't let me put words in your mouth.
No, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so you sign up for dramatic arts, and then what? You find that you really like it?
I found that I just really took to it, and I think I wanted to be an actor more than I actually should have been an actor. I mean, you know what I mean? I think I wanted to be involved in it because I didn't know that there were any other options in acting. And I think what happened as I finished high school and started looking to actually make it a career, I realized that there was this whole other world out there, a different side to the playmaking and the telling stories that I could get involved in. And that's, so I sort of drifted toward directing. And
okay, but you haven't mentioned writing, so did you never think to write?
I never really thought to write. I mean, my family wasn't an incredibly literate family. A lot of the stories that were told were all oral. I mean, we would read books, but you know, I'm the only person to graduate college in my family.
Wow. Of all the cousins?
Of all the cousins. Some have gone to junior college, but most of them, you know, they graduated high school and they started families. Many of them have, you know, I think my oldest cousin has, you know, a 7-year-old, and he's only a few years older than me.
Right.
I couldn't imagine having a 7-year-old right now.
This is really interesting because, so you're an anomaly in the family.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how does that feel?
It feels odd at times, but I mean they're very supportive and.
But they don't say you're not the black sheep kind of odd.
No, anomaly. No, no. I think they sort of work to understand my life and it's very different to them. But they're supportive and they really. They ask a lot of questions when we get together. They think it's very fun. I mean, they also don't get to see my work. I mean, some of them have only been on a plane a few times in their lives.
Right.
So it's not like they're just going to, you know, fly to New York. I have very few family members that have actually seen what I do.
Well, and maybe this isn't accurate, but even if they see what you do, most people don't understand what the director does.
Right.
So they wouldn't necessarily see what you do. I don't
right.
know how else to say it,
right.
you know?
And then usually when I tell people, family members, about my career and that I'm a director, they think, you know, they equate me to Steven Spielberg or think that those are my ambitions or something. They just immediately think about film directing
right.
as opposed to theater directing. It's just right. a foreign thing. But it's mostly because they don't go to the theater.
Right. But again, this is so interesting to me. I mean, it's not unusual for somebody to come out of a family where they're the only person who's an actor or they're the only person who's a singer or an artist or whatever. But I don't know. I keep seeing that scene of the, you know, sitting around the campfire with your grandfather, a clearly charismatic guy,
right.
you know, making up these stories almost as though that's who he should have been, you know. And how compelling that seems to me that it would be to kids. And so it's just interesting to me that nobody else found it, you know.
Yeah.
It just found you, you know. Well, okay, so you're in high school. Are you in plays?
Yes.
So, oh, right, you told me if you auditioned and you got the role, then you'd have to give up.
Yeah, so I did, and for a while, I didn't tell my grandfather right away that I quit football. I sort of waited until I got, like, my first big part in a play
right.
to really drop the bomb on him and just sit. And I just said, why don't you come and just see what I'm doing? And he did. It was a play called Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, my God, who were you?
I was Einstein.
Oh, which was, not Teddy.
No. But so that was like the first time when
it was a great play to start. I don't know. Did he like it?
Yeah, he did. That was hysterical.
Yeah, well, it's a great play.
And my great-grandmother was still alive at the time, and so they brought her, and she thought it was the funniest thing she'd ever seen.
Oh.
And so it was fun, you know. And then it just sort of got more serious, you know, as I moved on and went to college.
So did you choose a college based on theater? Or?
I did. I mean, I really wanted to leave. The Texas Educational Theater Program with all the high schools, there's a really close-knit network of high schools, and they do a lot of different things to support theater, and they try to push you, for obvious reasons, to go to local Texas schools,
right.
a lot of state colleges. And I really just wanted, at that point, I traveled a bit, but I wanted to get out. I wanted to live somewhere completely different. And so I went to Chicago.
So here you are, an anomaly again.
Right.
I mean, most of these people haven't been on a plane, and you couldn't wait to get out.
Yeah.
It's just interesting, that's all.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it was.
I don't think we can know what it is, but it is something.
Yeah. I think I just wanted to experience something new.
Yeah.
And so I went to Chicago and studied at Loyola University.
Mm-hmm.
And
still thinking you were an actor?
Yes. Yeah. And I did really, you know, it's funny, I started my first year of school there. I was cast in a lot of great roles as a freshman, and I realized that I just had a sense that I just had a sense that it wouldn't be what I ended up doing. I don't know what it was, but I just didn't think that it didn't feel right, and because I got so many great roles in that school, I left, because I just wanted to go someplace that I felt like I wanted to look up to really great actors ahead of me. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be like cast in the lead as a freshman because I just didn't think I was there.
Wow. I have to say, I think this is a very unusual thing for a young man.
Maybe.
I do.
I suppose.
I think a lot of young men would have thought, I'm it. I know how to do it, and I'm at the top of the food chain. And
yeah, that's what was so scary about it. I didn't want to be at the top of the food chain. I didn't feel like I knew anything. So I transferred to the University of Evansville, which is a really
Indiana?
Small school in Indiana. And it's an incredible theater program. Judd Williford, you know,
mm-hmm,
Judd?
I do.
He was a senior in my first year at the University of Evansville.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the type of actor that, you know,
yeah,
as a freshman or as a new person to a school, you look up to. And
right,
you're like, I want to learn how to do that.
Yeah, right.
And so that's why Evansville became such a great home to me, because there were lots of people like that, lots of really talented people to learn from who were a little older. And it was at Evansville that I decided to focus on directing. I acted until I was a senior, but I would take as many directing opportunities as I could get.
So they gave you an opportunity to direct?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah, your senior year, they choose two students to direct in a really gorgeous studio theater. It's like 100 seats or something.
So what did you direct?
I directed The Dining Room by A.R. Gurney.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I chose...
Oh, my God, all this...
All the different... The actors play each, like, 10 characters.
Yeah, yeah, and everybody's moving around. Oh, it's an interesting play to
direct. Yeah, it's really, really fun, and I had a nice time. And then from there, my wife, now then girlfriend, she was accepted to the MFA program at NYU. And so we moved
to New York.
New York,
here we come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, that was almost 10 years ago.
Wow.
So
then you made New York your home.
Yes.
And you moved to New York with her so she could do her, you know, but you didn't go on to a graduate program.
No, I applied, but it's very rare for a you know, someone straight out of undergrad to go to grad school for mm-hmm. directing, for good reason.
Yeah.
But I applied because I sort of felt like I knew everything at the time. And but moving to New York was terrific, very humbling. I was an intern at this theater called the Cherry Lane Theater, which is still there, but not doing so hot now. But and I was there for a number of years in various capacities, just trying to get anyone to let me
do anything.
And they were good to me, and then I got a job. I got a day job, and it looked like for a little bit that I was gonna not pursue theater, just because the realities of, you know, my wife and I got married, and she was getting out of graduate school, and all those financial realities.
And you have to pay the rent.
And you have to pay the rent,
right.
and you know, grad school loans, and this stuff.
Oh, God,
so.
Right.
I started doing corporate events, doing creative direction for corporate events, which is still creative in a
mm-hmm.
sense.
It's and still theatrical.
Still theatrical, mm-hmm. much more lucrative
yes.
than the theater.
Yeah.
But I had a great opportunity to assist on a Broadway show after I'd been working at that company for, after I'd been doing corporate events for, I don't know, 5 years or so. And I just used that as my way out.
Strategy,
yeah.
Right? What was the show?
It was Dangerous Liaisons.
Oh, my God. Not
yeah.
bad.
Yeah, it was great. It was a terrific experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like from then on, things, you know, opportunities.
You'd broken in.
Yeah, somehow it happened. And yeah.
Yeah, wow. So, now what you're doing, so you've been talking to Greg over these years about doing Tartuffe. Why?
Well...
And, I mean, did you know Greg from before?
Well, I met Greg when they also did Barnum a couple
mm-hmm.
years ago.
Yeah.
And I was doing a fellowship through this organization called the Drama League,
mm-hmm.
Which is a great organization in New York that gives four directors a year a really great opportunity to assist on a couple of big assisting projects. And also they give you a showcase in the city at the end of all of it. And so I was here assisting Gordon Greenberg on Barnum,
mm-hmm.
and it was a really fun experience because they, all of the third-year actors at the time from the conservatory, they were all part of this pre-show Carnival Barker experience,
yeah.
and that was sort of the thing that I got to do.
Oh,
so
you got to direct it.
I got to direct,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really a show, but it was an experience
yeah.
that the audience had when they came in, and so I sort of had that up, and the students were just so delightful and so much fun, and I really became friends with them and got to love the conservatory and what they do, and so I stayed in touch with Greg over the years, and It's just a great program.
But why Tartuffe?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, I think, for... I mean, I let Greg lead the way for a lot of it because he's trying to put together, you know, a curriculum mm-hmm. for these students, and he really wanted them to focus on verse and, you know, do something where the language was very tricky. Mm-hmm. He wanted it to be a comedy, and we wanted to use all of the actors.
Right, and so you were talking about it, and you said, what fits this criteria?
Right.
And up popped Tartuffe.
well, Molière. I mean, we looked at several Molière comedies, uh-huh. and...
He didn't want to do La Bête.
Well, you know, this was, I think, I don't know at what point they choose their season, but we didn't ever cross anything off the list. Mm-hmm. We started talking about what plays made sense, and the more we started talking about Molière, we started thinking about, well, why not the great ones,
right,
you know?
Right.
Like, if you're going to give these students an opportunity.
Right.
We're looking at plays like Don Juan, and which are all really good, but there's a reason, I think, that Tartuffe has, you know, survived, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, and is still one of the great plays.
Okay, so you were excited about the possibility of doing that, and it just showed up this season. They just got around to doing it this season. Is that the thing?
Well, yes. I mean, when I first started talking to Greg about directing in the conservatory, this was like the spring of 2009, and he said, you know, next season's all set, but let's start looking at the following season.
Right.
So then, you know, it took us a couple of years to arrive here.
Right. And then the sort of ironic happenstance of you being able to do the Steadfast at the same time.
Right.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Just tell us when Tartuffe is running from till?
Tartuffe starts performances on April 11th? April 12th?
God, I thought it was the 13th.
I think it opens on the 13th.
Opens on the 13th,
We have a preview performance on the 12th.
That's right, okay.
So we start performance on the 12th, we open on the 13th.
And it runs till?
It runs until May 1st.
First. Okay, good. And the Steadfast is what, Sunday or something?
Yeah, this Sunday at 7 p.m., April 3rd at 7 p.m.
How many people are in that? How big a cast?
It's 9 actors. It's a really fascinating, this is good.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. Good. So about, while I was doing corporate events, I became friends with my boss's husband, an artist, a landscape painter named Steve Alpert. And Steve and his wife both were very supportive over the years, coming to my plays and little black box theaters around the city. And we just became friends. And one time, about a year and a half ago, after seeing one of my performances, he approached me and said, I have this painting. He's a landscape painter, but he's done a series of military paintings. And doing these paintings and then donating them to Walter Reed Hospital and things like this, different military-focused charities. And so he showed me his biggest painting, his favorite painting, and said, I want you to help me turn this into a play.
Wow.
And I said, well, okay, but I don't write plays, but I can introduce you to some of my favorite playwrights, and then you can decide who should write it. And so one of my closest collaborators is this playwright named Matt Smart, and Steve and Matt hit it off right away.
Wow.
And so for the last almost 2 years, Matt and I have been working on this play with Steve, and it's just now seeing the light of day.
Oh, it's very exciting.
It's a really ambitious project. The painting depicts all of the 8 uniform eras, I want to get this right, all the 8 uniform eras of the United States Army.
Oh, you mean starting with the Civil War?
Starting with the
Revolution. Oh, no, the Revolution, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it goes. So there are 8 figures in the painting.
So there's a Revolutionary War.
Revolutionary War, War of
1812,
and then Spanish-American War.
Right.
Then Civil War.
It doesn't matter.
And then
World War One,
and then World War II and Korea have the same uniform.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, for the army, and then Vietnam War, and then the current war. I'm sure I forgot.
No,
one
I,
in
I
there.
think Oh, how many are there? 9? I think you had 8.
Yeah, there are 8. There are 8. And then there are 9 actors because there's one, not to give anything away, but there's one character in the play that sort of stands outside of it.
So is this cast with the conservatory or this cast
it's,
with
it's
all the actors?
It's cast with most of the first-year conservatory students, and then we have a couple third years. But yeah, it's all conservatory actors.
Wow, it's very exciting.
Yeah, we're really excited about it, and it's going to be terrific to have Matt here to work on it.
And is he here now?
He arrives tomorrow.
That's great. Well, all right. I always, again, ask the same question, and to some extent, this is what we've been talking about, but I like to frame it in this way. You have actually dedicated pretty much your entire life to this work, even the event planning thing. It's pretty much all about performance and drama and involving audiences,
mm-hmm.
you know. So do you want to just think for a second about what it means, what it feels like, what the experience of having dedicated a life to the theater, to the art of the theater, what that feels like, what you want to say about it?
Wow. I mean, it doesn't, I mean, it's interesting because I don't think about it in that way at all. I feel like I'm just starting out. I feel like I'm just beginning something.
Well, let me just stop you. I that may be true, but just the same, if you look back,
mm-hmm.
you see that it's always been about that.
Well, I mean, I feel like what's important to me about it, what's special to me about the theater is that it's about connection with people. And so I think the reason that I would rather be in a rehearsal room for a living as opposed to, you know, in front of a computer, although I spend a good amount of time in front of a computer,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, when I'm actually working, when I'm actually doing, creating the thing that I put out there, I'm doing it with other people. And that, for me, maybe it goes all the way back to the cousin thing, and, you know, I like playing with other people, and I like having them help me tell stories.
Yeah.
And so
you like the interaction.
I like the interaction. I like you know, creating something
yes.
with people.
Yes.
I think that the theater is a unique art form in that way.
Yeah, it's completely collaborative.
It's hard in a place like New York sometimes when you're starting out because you can't do it by yourself.
Right.
You could, but it wouldn't be very interesting. It wouldn't be very fun. You need other people to complete it. Even if you're doing a one-person show, you need other people to complete it. I really like creating work, and this is probably why I'm not a writer. I've tried to write things, and I've done small things, but I really like figuring things out in a room with other people. And
also, there's another thing just occurred to me, that the difference between writing the thing and directing the thing. This may not have meaning to you, but it has to me. Is the when you're writing the thing, it's all coming from you. When you're directing the thing, you're reacting to something someone else has done. Do you understand the difference I'm making?
Of course, yeah, yeah.
And I know for myself, you know, I've been on panels and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and there'll be a topic.
Mm-hmm.
I never want to be the first person to speak because I'm always more comfortable listening to what other people say and then incorporating what they say or mm-hmm. responding to what they say, right? And I am terrifically less interesting if you make me go first.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think it's kind of the same. Maybe this is a real stretch and it's not at all close.
No, that makes sense. Of course, that makes total sense. I mean, unless you're writing and directing it, that is exactly what's happening.
Right.
Someone has given you something.
Right.
And you're going to take it and do
and
something
do
else.
Do something with it.
Yeah.
Right.
So absolutely.
This had not occurred to me before as the difference, you know, a difference between writing and directing, that actually directors may be people who, not unlike myself, are stimulated by the need to respond to something that's there,
mm-hmm.
you know.
No, that's very exciting, and I think that's what's so great about working with new writers, and that's what's so great about working with Molière or, you know, very old pieces of work, is that there's an entire with a new play, there's a history, but it's quite different. And then with Molière, there's a terrific legacy, just sort of following that play, that you can look at past performances, and there's a whole slew of things that have come before with that play, not to mention just the historical context which created that, or which, you know, inspired that piece.
Right, that's great. So, okay, just in case there's something else you might want to say about the theater and your life in it and what you're looking forward to and any of that?
Well, I'm looking forward to doing a lot more of this.
Anything in particular that you would like to direct?
There are so many plays that I would like to direct. I'm just happy that there are people out in the world that keep telling me, yes, you can direct for a living.
Yes.
I think it's a really rare thing, and so many people get out of it for the obvious reasons, and I feel very fortunate to be one of the people that get told yes sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's quite true. I know you know what the percentages are. So,
I don't, but I...
Well, they're tiny.
It would terrify me.
But you know that. I mean, you know that, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so so I suspect it has something to do with your talent. And you don't have to say anything.
I don't know. Come see Tartuffe and
yes,
we'll
absolutely,
find out.
Absolutely. And The Steadfast.
Yeah, and The Steadfast,
yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Especially if people are... I mean, I know that Sarasota has a military population, and if there are any people in the military, we would love that sort of feedback. There's a Q&A after the Steadfast, and it's so helpful for Matt and I, and for Steve, who he's coming down also to see the presentation, so his painting will be here. And,
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing, because it's a story about the, you know, military history of the United States, the entire military history of the United States.
God.
And also, it's this great collaboration between visual art and theatrical art.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Yes, come on down at to the Oslo Unplugged series on Sunday at...
At 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m. And it's very little money. What is it?
It's free.
It's free. Never mind. And it's free. So please come and bring your... opinions.
Yes, definitely.
it's a good place to stop. Thank you so much, Wes.
Yeah, thank you. This was wonderful.
Good.
So, as I said at the beginning of the show, I'm really sorry I didn't get this show on in time for you to get down and see the reading of The Steadfast. But there is still time to see Tartuffe, which is currently playing at the historic Oslo Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And if you have never seen Tartuffe, you should not miss this opportunity to see this version. Not only is Wes's direction terrific, unbelievable, the translation is worth hearing for its own sake. It's remarkable. It's all in rhyme. And the actors are amazing. This is... as Wes said, this is the conservatory company, which means these are the students. And there are stars in this cast. Anyway, I'm going to play the review in case what I said is not enough. And so here it is. Tartuffe was written in 1664 by Molière, a French playwright and actor. It's the story of a family which is infiltrated by someone who is pretending to be godly, but is in fact a scoundrel. Tartuffe, devilishly played by Jeff Knox, convinces the head of the household, Orgon, convincingly played by Tony Stopperin, into believing that both he and his family must change their ways in order to live a better and more perfect life. They must give up fun and parties and become more pious, like the ever-praying Tartuffe. Expertly directed by Wes Grantham, who is based in New York, the production is set in Paris in 1915. According to Grantham, the early part of the 20th century was a time of great change in art, fashion, and religion. With so much change going on, it's very easy, says Grantham, for Tartuffe to slip into people's lives and take advantage. And take advantage he does. Tartuffe convinces Orgon that he must stop his daughter Marion, winningly played by Ashley Scallon, from marrying the man she loves and to whom she's been promised, and instead marry her to Tartuffe. At the same time as he is proposing to marry Orgon's daughter, Tartuffe is lusting after and attempting to seduce Orgon's wife, Elmire, who heroically and hysterically defends her honor. Tartuffe also so harasses Orgon's son, Damis, that the boy is brought to the brink of madness, and Orgon disinherits him, making Tartuffe his heir. Always working to hold the family together is the delightful housemaid, Doreen, charmingly and deftly played by Megan DeLay. She is always in the know and continually bucks up whoever is befuddled and in misery. And just when it looks like all is lost, all is saved. Molière wrote his plays using poetry to tell the story. The translation used in this offering is by Richard Wilbur and is excellently brought to us by a very talented cast. The story and the individual scenes are clearly understood, and because the clarity of speech and understanding by each of the actors is the best. Others in the cast include Katie Cunningham, who starts the story up in a brilliant turn as Madame Pernell, Gretchen Porow, whose M. Loyal's diatribe make the others weak in the knees, John Michael Miller, Benjamin Boschwald, and Jake Staley. Do go to see this delightful performance of a very entertaining and at the same time a very relevant play about people so focused on appearances and what others will think that they allow themselves to be completely swindled. The production runs through May 1st at the historic Oslo Theater in the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art, 5401 Bayshore Road in Sarasota, Florida. That review, although read by me, was written by Pamela Wiley, actor, director, extraordinaire. But we couldn't get the recorder to Pam, so she sent me the text and I read it. I want to say again about Tartuffe, I thought I had seen it or read it at some time in my life, but I hadn't. So it was a terrific surprise, shall I say, a delightful surprise, and I hope that you get to see it. So The Lynn Show is about becoming who you really are. And you can hear in Wes's story the emerging of who he really is, the beginnings of it, where he's a jock, you know, just like the other guys, like the rest of his cousins, like the rest of his family. But the emerging recognition that he is drawn to stories, to performance, to theater, this underlying awareness that is sort of always there as a muzak, so to speak, and that he makes conscious in a way because he gets an opportunity to choose dramatic arts in school. And then his concern about presenting this aspect of himself to his grandfather and father, men that he admires, loves, wishes to please, but is not sure that they will approve. And then the growing understanding that the being drawn to theater is not about acting, but about directing. The recognition that he is a person who wants to tell stories in collaboration with others. That's who he is. That's what he wants to do. So this is an example of someone who pretty much always knew who he was, but it took him time to be able to risk exposing that, recognizing it, bringing it out, demonstrating it. But once recognized, you can hear the congruence. You can hear the connection between the way he lives his life and the person that he is. And this is what I'm hoping for all of you. So I'm hoping that you heard it and that something inside of you is leaping up and down in the background, maybe even like Muzak, saying, paint, let's paint, or let's play tennis, or let's be more assertive, or let's get out of this situation, whatever it is. Anyway, if you have any comments about this, please email me. Remember, thelinshow.com. Don't forget the E in Lynn. As always, I need to thank Josh Hackney for everything that he does, not only to make the show as good as it can be, but to mentor me and hold my hand through all of the technology that I am now having to learn. If you need any help with any of that, as always, you want Josh Hackney. He's the man, and you can get him by going up on my website and clicking on email me and saying I want Josh, and I'll get him for you. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that interested you, amused you, even if it annoyed you, just something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week. Same time, same station, and as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten